It's a proverb we've all heard before, whether it be in a song.
Confession is good for the soul.
Or a TV show.
It was an old Cardassian expression. Confession is good for the soul.
Or a sermon.
Confession is good for the soul. Would you say that with me? Confession is good for the soul. I don't think I could talk about a growth spurt without talking about confession, because at some point in your life, you're going to have a season where you are thinking about something you should not be thinking about, doing something you should not be doing. And the only way you are going to course correct is to confess. You can't try to work your way out of it, keep it a secret and try to just, oh, we're just going to act like that didn't happen. I'll just do good from now on. The only way you're going to get right is to actually confess.
Indeed, many assume the proverb has biblical origin, but it doesn't appear in either the Old or New Testament. Instead, most trace its origin to an old Scottish proverb that said open confession is good for the soul. Many have observed that the modern version of the proverb omits the word open, which critically changes its meaning because an open confession is fundamentally different from a private one. And indeed, it is this difference that could very well have led to Darrell Ewing's conviction back in 2010 and now his freedom in 2021.
Welcome to Undisclosed, The State versus Darrell Ewing. This is the second episode in a four-episode series about Darrell Ewing, who was convicted of the 2009 murder of J.B. Watson in Detroit, Michigan. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
In episode 1, we laid out the basics of what happened to J.B. Watson on December 29th, 2009. At around 3:40 p.m., while he was in his girlfriend's Astro van at a red light at the intersection of Van Dyke and Harper on the east side of Detroit, he was fatally shot. Meanwhile, Darrell Ewing and his family claimed that at this exact time, Darrell was 5.5 miles away at a repast, helping set up the slideshow to honor the life of his grandmother's best friend, Gloria Chesternut. According to Darrell, he heard about J.B. Watson's murder that same night.
Before you got arrested, was there any point at which you had heard that this man, J.B. Watson, had been killed?
Well, I heard J.B. Watson got killed the same night that he died.
Uh-huh. Did you know J.B. Watson?
No, I did not know him.
Okay. And so you heard that night that he had been killed. What was your reaction when you heard that he'd been killed?
I mean, it was a sad moment, but it isn't really... I heard about it and it was keep on moving.
Right. Because you don't know him and you've maintained all these years, right, that you had nothing to do with his death.
Yeah, I had nothing to do with the case. I didn't know him. You know, people die in Detroit every day. You know what I mean? When I heard it, I kept on moving. It was really nothing that affects me or dealt me because I didn't know him personally.
Darrell Ewing wasn't actually the first person arrested in connection with the murder of J.B. Watson. That person was a man named Derico Searcy.
So first of all, how well do you know Derico?
I know Derico from our neighborhood. Derico's an older guy in our neighborhood.
On New Year's Eve, just 2 days after J.B. Watson was murdered, Derico Searcy was arrested. As with the death of J.B. Watson, Darrell says he heard about this event but didn't pay it much mind.
Do you hear about it when he gets arrested?
Did I hear about Derico getting arrested? Yeah, I heard when he got... Yes, I did hear about him getting arrested. Yes, sir.
And how did you hear about that, and what was your reaction to that?
I didn't even know what he got arrested for, so it wasn't really a reaction, you know. It's like when people get locked up in the neighborhood, you always hear, oh, he went to jail today. That's exactly how it was.
Right, so you hear he's arrested, but you have no idea what he's arrested for, and you have...
Yeah, no idea.
Right.
Idea what he was arrested for.
Next, fast forward another 11 days to January 11th, 2010. Darrell was going to pick up a car when he was met with the full force of the law.
So on January 11th, I think you're in a red Pontiac. And yeah, could you sort of set the scene what you remember about that day that you're arrested?
The day I got arrested, I remember that I had called a friend to take me out to Pontiac Trails to pick up a car that I was getting ready to buy and take to the shop. And about 45 minutes later, they came and picked me up. When we got outside, we got in the car. And so we got in the car, I was ready to pull off. All type of FBI and DEA and sheriffs actually jumped out the car, you know what I mean? And from there, ever since that moment, I've been locked up.
For Darrell, who had just turned 21, this was a shocking and startling situation.
An officer came walking up with a paper with a face on it, and then he said, slam him to the ground and cuff him. And he was talking about me, and so I was real shocked, you know what I mean? I'm dumbfounded, like, what you mean? Who are you talking about? You can't be talking about me, you know what I mean? And then they quickly did it, followed suit, and threw me onto the ground and cuffed me up. And then they put me on the squad car, the first squad car that I seen on the scene. And that's when I first learned that they was charging me with homicide, taking me down for murder. And I'm like, what?
Darrell wasn't the only one shocked by his arrest. Here's his mother, Lasagna Dotson.
The day that they came to the house to get him, he's 21 years old. You're coming to pick him up for a murder. You call his mother. I did marketing and sales for S Cable Company. I worked in the field, so I was actually out. And they said, Ms. Dotson, we have your son. We want to know if you could come home. We need to speak with you. So he's in the house. They don't go in. They don't search the home. They got him as a shooter. And they never searched my house. They don't have a weapon, but they never searched the house.
This is maybe the oddest investigative omission we've seen in all of our years of Undisclosed. Way back in season one, we questioned the decision of Baltimore police officers not to search the home of the grandmother of alleged accomplice Jay Wilds for the shovels that he allegedly used to bury the body of Haman Lee. But here, the police in Detroit believed that Darrell Ewing was the gunman in the murder of J.B. Watson, and yet they never searched his mother's home for a firearm, despite never being able to link any gun to Darrell. Of course, this leads to the obvious question. Did the Detroit police actually believe Darrell was the gunman? Both Darrell and his mother think the answer is no. Here's his mom.
Then they go in. When they come in, they give me a card. They tell me that, Ms. Dotson, we know that your son didn't do it, but who will he talk to?
Right.
And I'm like, he'll talk to me. You know, I said, he'll talk to me. I'm the one. I'm his sole provider. I'm the one who's here for him, right?
Meanwhile, Darrell says that the police were singing a similar tune when they took him to the police station and put him in the interrogation room.
And what they told me is he told me that he knew that I didn't do it, but if I don't tell him who did it, he's going to do everything in his power to make sure I go down for it. That's exactly what he told me.
All right, so let me break this down. Do you remember the name of the officer who was speaking with you?
His name was T.O. Sergeant Williams.
Okay. So Theo Williams, he specifically tells you, I know you didn't do it. But if you don't talk, you're going down for this?
Yeah, that's what he told me. Yes, sir.
Does he tell you how he knows you didn't do it?
He never told me. He didn't know how I did it, but what was mind boggling me. I say, you know that I didn't do it, but you're telling me that you're going to actually put these charges on me if I don't tell and corroborate with you? And that's when he told me that. And I told him, if you got something on me, he produced it in the courtroom, then I'll see you at trial, you know?
And does he tell you specifically what he wants from you?
Well, he wanted to know who was involved. That's specifically what he said. He said, I know you didn't do it, but you know who did. This is the exact words. Mm-hmm. I know you didn't do it, but if you don't tell me who did it, I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure you go down for it.
When Darrell refused to play ball, things quickly escalated.
So I told him, hey, listen, I'm out of here. Not done questioning there. I told him I need my attorney. And when I told him that, he said, I promise you, you're going to need him.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm done with you.
And is that it, or does he continue talking with you more?
No, that was it. Then he took me back to the bullpen. At first, I was in the men's arena cell, so I thought it was actually just like a regular, legit question. They had questioning going on. And when he took me back, because they had me in the men's arena cell at the very beginning when I got there, so I'm like, okay, yeah, this is a 72-hour hold or something. They trying to do some questioning or something. Boom. When, after we get done with the interrogation room, he takes me back, and we pass the misdemeanor cell, he takes me back to the felony cell. They place me in the felony cell, and I'm in there for about an hour. When I'm in there for about an hour, another officer comes up, he got a sign on a piece of paper waking me up out of my sleep. When he wakes me up out of my sleep, he says on a piece of paper, he said, help me, I can help you. Tell me anything you know about that murder or any drugs, and I can help you out. And that was the last time I had any indications with the police, and then when I told them to get the hell off.
And so, with Darrell refusing to talk to the police, they brought in his mom.
As it goes on, Darrell, like, I don't know nothing about it. I don't know, you know, as he is in jail, and I tell him, I said, Darrell, when I get down there, I need for you to talk to me, because I need to know how to help you, you know. I need to know everything. Like, don't leave anything out. If anything, I need to know what's going on. So when I got down there, he was saying, like, man, I wasn't there. I was with y'all, and this happened.
The way that Darrell sees it, the murder of J.B. Watson was pinned on him because he wouldn't, and indeed couldn't, pin the murder on someone else.
My case is a case that many doesn't get covered, although aspect of the guys who goes to prison and who get charged and don't tell on someone who they may know committed the crime. And because you don't tell, the prosecutors and the police turn around and fabricate and trump them charges on you. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That's what my situation is. If you actually want to get to the truth of the matter, that's what is actually my situation. And it's the situation of many more guys who sit behind these walls. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I think they call that the innocent prisoner's dilemma. You went down on these charges because they wanted to force you to say something that wasn't true and you wouldn't play ball with them, and so they got you on these murder charges that aren't in fact true.
Right, that's what it is. If you don't play with their ball, they turn around and they have the aspect or the mentality, if I can't get the right one, I'll get to one of y'all ass. You know, that's the mentality that they embrace with coming up with these cases in these urban communities.
The innocent person's dilemma recognizes that the innocent often fare worse than the guilty in the criminal justice system. On the back end, when it comes time for parole, the guilty inmate can offer what the innocent inmate cannot, a confession and a real shot at freedom. And on the front end, the guilty defendant can offer that same confession to get a plea deal, or worse, as we've seen far too often, that guilty defendant knows enough about the crime depending on somebody else, while the innocent defendant lacks a convenient fall guy. Last episode, we analogized Darrell Ewing to Walter McMillian from Just Mercy, but in this sense, his case is also similar to another person in the book and movie, Anthony Ray Hinton.
On the movie Just Mercy, O'Shea Jackson was playing Anthony Ray Hinton, and he said that he told the police that he was innocent, and then he said the police told him, well, if you didn't do it, you take one for your homie. That's a prime example of what happened in this case, clear as day.
But while this is how Darrell sees things in 2021, he had no idea when he initially refused to name names that this is where he'd end up.
At that point, I still didn't even believe it was true, you know what I mean? I thought that they was going to just go through the formalities and I'll be clear, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it never hit me at the time I was at the precinct that I was actually going to be charged with this case, you know what I mean? I'm thinking they're going to have me clear and not be up out of this mess, you know? That's what I thought.
But as soon as Durrell was taken downtown for arraignment, things started coming into focus.
Until later on that day, they came up and they told me I'm going to get arraigned. I was actually taken downtown. They had to shuttle us downtown. And then that's when I got downtown and to the county jail, that's when I seen Mr. Searcy. And I found out what the heck was had already been going on. What was the process and how would I hear, you know what I mean?
As noted, Derico Searcy had been arrested about 2 weeks earlier. So he was able to share information with Durrell about the case.
So it finds out when I get down there downtown to Mr. Searcy, he's already there with discovery packet in this case. And
okay.
That's where I find out where the hell all this is coming from.
And so, through the discovery packet, Durrell was able to learn what the state was alleging. That Derico had driven Durrell to the intersection of Van Dyke and Harper, that Durrell had gotten out of the car and opened fire on the occupants of the Astro van and fatally shot J.B. Watson, and that Durrell had then gotten back into the car so that Derico could hightail it out of there. Seeing what the state was alleging was like a punch in the gut to Durrell.
And so at this point now, it's pretty real for you, right? Now you know this isn't something that's going to just go away. And so when that sinks in for you, what are you thinking and feeling?
Actually, when I actually discovered, you know, I had a cold chill go through my body, and I shook and almost like fell to the ground. Like, this can't be true, you know what I mean? And I'm looking at the papers of the witnesses, and they saying he looked close. And all my mind is telling me, oh, we got to get in here so I can be clear to this, because they say he looks close. When I get in there, they go, damn, sure gonna say it ain't me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That was going through my mind.
Durrell is not the only one who had this reaction. Durrell had been arrested on January 11th, 2010. Now, let's fast forward about 6 months to July 21st, 2010. With their son having been in jail for over half a year at that point and his trial rapidly approaching, LaSonia Dodson now got word that the FBI was involved in the case.
I remember the day that the FBI came in with the sealed documents about Christopher Richardson. And I literally could not get out the bed that day. I was so sick to my stomach, like I'm losing my baby. So I didn't know what to do. So what was starting without me? I was laying in the bed, like literally crying and sick. And they called me and said, you better get up and get here. They just came here with some CO documents or whatever.
Meanwhile, Durrell had his own qualms that day.
At what point do you first hear that Christopher Richardson has come forward?
Actually, my lawyer had just been out of town and he had got back in town and we had court or something and we was coming in and he hadn't made it to the back. Normally the procedure is for your attorney before y'all go on a record is for that they come back and ask you any questions and then give you anything that they gonna discuss or anything new that he have, you know what I mean? But that day it didn't happen on this court date. And I'm like, man, what the heck going on? I'm thinking it's a dry run. They have dry runs in our county jail where they try to wake guys up early in the morning, 3 a.m, take you down to the bullpen, then take you to court. They do this repeatedly. It's a process of, like, tiring guys.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Trying to get them to plea out and everything, but this is what I thought it was. So when I actually got in the courtroom and seen that we was actually having court, and this is when I reread, he said, my attorney, David Chris, I asked him, where have you been, man? What's going on? Why you ain't come to the back and holler at me? He told me, sit back, hold on. You ain't going to believe this here. And then that's when I found out about the Christopher Richardson stuff as he went on record.
So what did this individual, Christopher Richardson, have to say? We have the transcript from the July 21st hearing, and his statement came out of the proffer sessions that Richardson had in connection with carjacking charges that had been brought against him and his alleged accomplice, Tyree Washington. Here's what defense counsel David Cripps informed the judge about the sealed FBI documents.
As the court knows, I was out of the country until yesterday, which would have been July 20th. I went and reviewed a lot of things last night that were brought to my house by my secretary. And one of the things that I reviewed was a letter dated July 14th, 2010, from Prosecutor Cam Towns, who is obviously the prosecutor on this case. What the letter was, is its disclosure that someone else other than my client may have been the shooter in this case. What I've received is the facts that Special Agent Matt Allen and Detroit Police Officer Scott Herzog interviewed a person by the name of Christopher Richardson, pertaining to the shooting of the deceased in this particular case and what they were told. And I have a paragraph, three paragraphs of obviously a much larger document, which indicates that Tyree Washington told Christopher Richardson that Tyree Washington and a Mr. Beal, B-E-A-L, were responsible for the murder of Knockout Boys member Isaiah in the area of Harper and Van Dyke, Detroit, Michigan. That's the deceased, location of shooting of the deceased in our case. Going on specifically, Washington was the shooter at that homicide, our homicide. Washington has told several individuals at the Macomb Jail that Washington was responsible for the Harper Van Dyke homicide. The shooting was over an unknown female. I have now received information obviously that I have to pursue, and I hope that the prosecution, in the interest of justice, will also pursue in terms of who the real shooter in this case is. And obviously now I can see that my client didn't do the shooting, and I have to pursue this further.
Understandably, Darrell Ewing was thrilled by this turn of events.
And so what's your reaction when you hear that Christopher Richardson is saying that Tyree Washington confessed to this murder?
My reaction was, I was actually, felt kind of relieved that the truth was finally coming out, that I was actually sitting there wrongfully convicted, or charged at that time, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because they were so vigorous in pursuing me, you know what I mean? I just couldn't believe that this guy had came forth and was actually telling on his own cousin and his best friend, you know?
And how well, if at all, do you know Tyree Washington?
I know Tyree Washington. That's a real good, that was a real good friend of mine at that time.
Uh-huh. And so when you get this news that Christopher Richardson has come forward, do you think that's it? Charges are going to be dropped, trying to be found innocent?
Yeah, I thought that at that moment the prosecutor was going to go pursue this lead, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And have me clear.
Unfortunately for Darrell, this is not what happened. The charges weren't dropped, and Tyree Washington did not end up testifying at Darrell's trial. This takes us back to the introduction, the religious association that many place upon the proverb about confession being good for the soul, and the difference between private and open confessions. While Tyree Washington didn't testify at trial, he did sign an affidavit after Darrell was convicted that stated the following in pertinent part.
I first took responsibility for this murder in 2011. I was incarcerated and studying the teachings of the Nation of Islam, which professes that individuals should take responsibility for their actions. I got the inspiration from those teachings to step up and not allow two people, Ewing and his co-defendant, to spend the rest of their lives in prison for something that I did. At the time I took responsibility for Mr. Watson's murder, I signed a sworn affidavit, and it was given to Cam Towns, the prosecutor handling Mr. Ewing's case during Mr. Ewing's trial. My attorney delivered the affidavit to Ms. Towns and told her I wanted to testify. Ms. Towns' response was that she already had the perpetrator she was looking for and did not need me to testify.
Now we have to admit that while we have this post-trial affidavit by Tyree Washington, we don't have a copy of the pretrial affidavit that he mentions. And Darrell Ewing's trial began in late 2010, which is before Tyree Washington says he had his epiphany. So while the timeline's unclear, what is clear is that he didn't testify at trial. Instead, there was testimony by Christopher Richardson, who, as noted, was Tyree Washington's alleged accomplice in a carjacking case. According to Richardson, Tyree Washington confessed to killing J.B. Watson on two separate occasions. The first time was when Richardson was at his cousin William Beal's house on January 26, 2010. Richardson testified that Washington told him that, quote, he laid Isaiah down. Richardson then testified that Isaiah was J.B. Watson and that he took Washington to mean that he had killed Watson. Meanwhile, the second confession was when Richardson was locked up with Tyree Washington in the Macomb County Jail. According to Richardson, Washington told him he'd killed J.B. Watson at the intersection of Harper and Van Dyke. Richardson testified that Washington said he was in a green Aurora with William Beal and Adrian Jackson, and they were following the van that Watson was in.
Now, for reference, Beale is Richardson's cousin, and Jackson is the mother of Beale's child. So anyway, when they reached the intersection, Washington got out of the Aurora, tapped in the van's window, and then opened fire, shooting LP in the hand, and then shooting Watson, who was in the front passenger seat. Now think back to a few key points from episode 1. Willie Williams, another passenger in the Astro van, said he heard something like rocks hitting the van before the shooting started, which could have been Washington tapping on the window. And LP was the nickname for Philip Reed, who testified at trial that he was in the van and that a bullet took off a piece of his finger. Finally, according to Richardson, Tyree Washington testified the shooting, quote, started over a girl. And that girl was a woman named Nita, who is Adrian Jackson's sister.
To corroborate Richardson's claims, the defense also called LaJoya Stevenson, who is Darrell Ewing's cousin and had been dating Tyree Washington at the time of the shooting. Stevenson remembered the day of the shooting because it was the day of Gloria Chesternut's funeral and repast, which she couldn't attend because she did hair and, quote, couldn't miss the money that day. Stevenson testified that Washington came to her place that night sometime after dinner and told her he was about to tell her something that she couldn't tell anyone. He then said, I shot someone today. Stevenson asked Washington where, and he responded, on Van Dyke. When Stevenson asked Washington why, he responded, I shot him because he would have shot me if I didn't. Stevenson next asked if the guy he shot was dead, and Washington answered, I don't know, but I didn't stay to see if he was. I think he's dead. I think he is. Finally, Stevenson testified that Washington told her that Will and Nana, in other words, William Beale and Adrian Jackson, were in the car with him. Later, after Darrell had been arrested, Stevenson saw Washington again, and she asked him whether Darrell had been arrested for a crime he had committed. He responded, No, that's got nothing to do with that. Your cousin's good. And as Darrell's trial drew to a close, he thought he was good.
But in my mind, I'm knowing these jurors are about to clear me, you know what I mean? Because all the doubt in the world has already came out, you know what I mean? This guy come forth testifying against his friend and against his own family member. I mean, the truth was in the pudding. It was nothing but doubt already laid there, provided by the federal government. Nothing contrived or presented by the defense, something that the federal government brought forth, you know what I mean? So when it came forth, I just knew that the jury was going to immediately come back and acquit me, you know what I mean?
But instead, the jury found him guilty.
And so then what's your reaction when you're there in the courtroom and you hear the words that the jury has found you guilty?
I can't believe it. I lost my mind. I mean, I flew off the rails in that thing because, you know, I'm sitting here, they crying, they come out crying and in tears, but they actually and they turn around and convict me. You know what I mean? It was just one of those moments that I couldn't believe it. You know what I mean? Like, how?
As noted, after Darrell was convicted, Tyree Washington signed an affidavit giving a confession that largely lined up with the testimony given by Christopher Richardson. But now we have something even more significant, a recorded interview that Washington has given to private investigator Scott Lewis.
I want to ask you about the December 29th, 2009 fatal shooting of J.B. Watson. Are you familiar with that incident?
Yes, I am.
What do you know about it?
Well, I know everything about it. I was there, and I actually was the shooter of that incident, sir.
Okay. Where did this take place?
On Van Dyke and Harper.
Okay. Can you describe how this shooting occurred? What kind of vehicle you were in? What kind of vehicle Mr. Watson was in? And who else was in his vehicle?
Yes, I was in a aqua green, bluish Aurora. And they were, JB and the rest of his defendants, they was in a burgundy, like, minivan.
Okay, do you know who the other people were in the van with J.B. Watson?
Just the only person else J-I-L-P.
Okay.
So, how did Washington pull off the shooting?
I followed him for a little while, and when we approached the light at Van Dyke and Harper, they was kind of boxed in and couldn't go nowhere. And I saw that as an opportunity for me to get out and pursue to shoot at him. So I pulled my car over, and I jumped out behind the van. When I jumped out behind the van, I started letting shots off in the back of the van. Let about 13 shots off in the back of the van.
And then what happened?
Then they tried to, like, whoever the driver was, tried to get out of the jam they was in, so they hit a few cars trying to pull off, and I proceeded, got back into my vehicle, and took off.
This statement by Washington lines up with the testimony of J.B. Watson's girlfriend, Loretta Thomas, who, as we noted last episode, testified that she struck vehicles while desperately driving away from the shooting. Washington's statement also lines up with Richardson's testimony about who was in the car with Washington at the time of the shooting.
There was a driver of your vehicle, correct?
Yes, there was a driver of the vehicle.
Will you name that person?
Her name was Adrian. Yes, her name was Adrian Jackson.
Okay. And what relation was Adrian to you?
She was like a sister, but nothing, not blood, but one of my closest friends, child's mother.
Did she know what you were going to do?
No, she did not.
Okay.
It was actually me, her, and her son's father, who was all together.
Okay. And were you the only one that knew that you were going to do the shooting?
Yes, sir.
Furthermore, Washington's statement also lines up with his prior claim that he told prosecutor Cam Towns that he was guilty and was turned away by her.
I actually wrote an affidavit and had it notarized at the facility I was at and sent it in to the court, to the prosecutor Cam Towns. And I actually had my lawyer, Natasha Webster, come in contact with Cam Towns. Mm-hmm. And the response back from Cam Towns to my lawyer, Natasha Webster, was that they had the perpetrators they was looking for. She didn't really need me to come testify against anything because my lawyer told her I was willing to testify, and she said she didn't need me. She had who she felt was responsible for this, and that was that.
So, why did Washington shoot J.B. Watson?
A couple of days prior to that, him and his friends had just came and shot at us and almost shot a couple of my friends. And it was going back and forth. They had came around, and I was with my daughter and my daughter's mother and a few of her friends, and they came shooting. So, it was a lot of that, a lot of shooting, and I was just tired of it, man.
So was it kind of a revenge for them shooting at you?
Yes, sir. Well, like I said, it started over with some females, and they came by and started shooting at us. So, yeah, that's how it started to be, yeah.
In many cases, the state tries to discredit an alleged confession by an incarcerated alternate suspect on the grounds that the suspect knows he's not being released and can help someone else out without hurting himself in any meaningful way. But that's not the case here.
Are you willing to testify in court?
Yes, sir.
What is your current expectation for getting out of prison on the charge you're currently incarcerated for? When would you be set to get out of prison?
2019, April.
So you're not doing a life offense at this point?
No, sir.
So you're essentially confessing to something that would give you a life sentence?
Yes, sir.
And this is no longer just a theoretical possibility. We've checked the records, and Tyree Washington has now been released on parole. He's a free man who could live the rest of his life outside of prison walls if he stays on the straight and narrow. Instead, he's willing to give what the jurors did not hear at Darrell Ewing's trial back in 2010, an open confession from the real McCoy. So, why is Tyree Washington willing to spend the rest of his life in prison when he could live a life of freedom if he simply kept his mouth shut?
I had got locked up, and when I got locked up and I was incarcerated, you know, first I was stagnant about it. Then I started following the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, which is the Nation of Islam. And it teaches us how to be responsible for our actions and how to step to the plate. So after studying that for so long, I got the encouragement from those teachings to step up and say enough is enough and not to let two innocent men sit in penitentiary for something that I did. And that's all the motivation I need.
In this case, then, confession, and indeed open confession, has been good for Tyree Washington's soul. But will it be good for Jarrell Ewing's chances of finally being exonerated for the murder of J.B. Watson? Next time on Undisclosed. Thanks for listening to this week's Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Of course, I'd like to thank our sponsors. As always, you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at the handle @UndisclosedPod, and you can support our Patreon @UndisclosedPod.